Har du et enkeltpersonforetak eller en liten bedrift? Da du sikkert lei av å høre meg snakke om hvor enkelt det med kvitteringer og bilag i fiken. Så vi gir oss her, fordi vi liker enkelt. Fiken. Superenkelt regnskap.
Halv pris på Domino's pizza? Ja, i morgen det Crazy Tuesday og halv pris på alle medium pizza hos Domino's.
Det stemmer. Halv pris på pizza hver tirsdag.
Bestill på dominos.no eller i appen.
Crazy Tuesday hver tirsdag hos Domino's.
Velkommen til Engler og hormoner. Inspirasjon og ny kunnskap om helse, selvutvikling og livsstil.
Dr. Louise Newson is a GP and menopause specialist and holds an advanced menopause specialist certificate with Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Healthcare. She is passionate about increasing awareness and knowledge of the perimenopause and menopause and campaigns for better menopause care for all women. So a warm welcome to you, Louise.
Thank you.
It's such a big honor to have you here with us from Oslo.
So would you add something to your introduction? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yes, of course. So I'm a GP and, like you say, a menopause specialist, but I'm also a menopausal woman. And I think that makes a big difference, actually. I wasn't given any training about the menopause or the perimenopause or sex hormones at all, really, as when I was training as an undergraduate many years ago. And then I did a lot of hospital medicine. And then I went into general practice, but I've always had a portfolio career. So I've done lots of different jobs, making up a full-time job. So I have done a lot of medical writing, a lot of medical education. I've also got a pathology degree. So I'm quite interested in basic science as well. And so when I started to learn more about the menopause, because for many years, all we've been told about the menopause is it's some flushes and sweats and women just get through them. And then I started to think, well, what's happening? What is going on in our body? Well, it's related to our hormones, these three hormones, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, and the levels are low. What happens to our body? What are the pathological processes that happen? And the more I read, the more I was outraged that women and healthcare professionals and men were not learning the same information. So the last 8 years, I've been doing a lot of work writing about what it actually means, unpicking the evidence, looking at the benefits as well as any risks of hormone replacement therapy, as well as setting up a clinic, but also educating people through the Balance app, which is this free app we've created, and for healthcare professionals as well, creating a course for them. Because in my mind, everybody should be able to access the right care, advice, and treatment for them. But it's a massive global problem because there's 1.2 billion menopausal women, and only about 5% of those women are getting treatment. So we have a long way to go.
Wow. And also in the studio, we have Ida Vågsbø Bjørntvedt.
Yeah.
And you are the Norwegian, let's say, up-and-coming superstar on hormonal treatment for menopause women. And we are very happy that you're taking this interest because a lot of the reason why we sit here is because of you.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Mona. Yeah, I was inspired about hormones when I did my training as a gynecologist. So that's a little different from the UK, where I guess most GPs are prescribing HRT. Mm. Obviously, they do that in Norway as well, but more gynecologists do this as well, maybe mainly gynecologists in Norway. So, but as the more you read about this and your interest, the more you want to know. Mm. So we are so honored that you are here today, Louise, and your team, and that we can learn even more from you. So thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Because in Norway, I think we have not come as far as you have in the UK about being aware of the possibilities to get treatment when you reach perimenopause and menopause. Mm. And I would love to hear more, Louise, about what you think is important that we know when we reach this age.
Yeah, it's really important, actually, that everybody knows. And if we just think about what the menopause is, if we break down the word menopause, the meno bit is menstrual cycle, so a woman's periods, and a pause is obviously stop. What's really, I think, annoying and frustrating, actually, is that to make the official diagnosis of menopause, you have to have stopped your periods for 12 months. Now, as a doctor, I don't want to be waiting 12 months to make a diagnosis for someone. Or if someone has had 11 months without a period and is having lots of symptoms, do I then say, come back in a month's time? Of course I don't. That just doesn't seem right. But then also there's a lot of women that don't have periods. They might have had a hysterectomy. They might have using contraception. That means they don't have periods. So if we only define the menopause as stopping periods, it doesn't feel right. And then some people say, well, it's about loss of fertility. Actually, some women who are young, who have an early menopause, will still be fertile, as you know. So that doesn't sit right either. So that's why thinking about, well, what is happening? Well, our ovaries aren't working as well. So the hormone levels decline, but they don't just switch off overnight, unless, of course, someone has their ovaries removed in an operation, and then they will become menopausal overnight. But most of us, they just decline gradually and often in quite a chaotic way. So that's why we often talk about the perimenopause. And peri just means around the time of, and that's when the hormone levels are changing. But I don't know what the average age of the menopause is in Norway, but in the UK, people quote it's around the age of 51. But the perimenopause can last 10 years or so before. So women in their 40s will be perimenopausal. But we know recent figures have shown about 1 in 30 women under the age of 40 will have an early menopause. We call it premature ovarian insufficiency, or POI. Lots of reasons, but mostly we don't know why it happens. But very young people can be menopausal too. My youngest patient was 14 when she was diagnosed. So it's not something we need to wait until we're older before we learn about it, because there will be people who will be younger experiencing symptoms and often being misdiagnosed and no one thinking about that it being related to their hormones.
Mm-hmm. So,
so can I ask you, Louise, what can you tell us a little bit about Women's Health Initiative that basically made it really hard for women all over the world to get HRT treatment for so long?
There's been so much, hasn't there? And I think there's lots of reasons, and I'll go through them. But initially, if you look in the history of time, so before people really understood hormones and what they were doing, you only need to think about the Greek word for hyst, which is for womb. Mm. And then that's why hysterectomy is removal of the womb. But look at the word hysteria. Mm. It's exactly the same, isn't it? It's derived from... So in Greek times, and then in many generations, actually, they thought women were mad. They were worried. And actually, there is in history books, they say that women were better when they had their periods. Mm-hmm. So when they stopped their periods, they did all sorts of things. They used leeches. They used to cut us to try and get blood from our system to try and help our mental state. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know then about hormones. And then when they discovered the sex hormones, especially estrogen, it was associated with hot flushes. Mm. Whereas when they discovered thyroxine, it was associated with a disorder, a disease. Mm. Mm. And so that's why our sex hormones haven't been taken seriously, really. Mm. And then even calling them sex hormones, they're not about sex and they're not about gender, because men have estrogen, progesterone, testosterone too. So then they've not belong anywhere, really. I think in medicine, obviously, people have different specialties. So if you have a heart problem, you see a a cardiologist. If you have a brain problem, you see a neurologist. If you have a hormone problem, you see an endocrinologist. But if you have a sex hormone problem, then often it goes to gynecologists, but gynecologists treat the pelvic organs, not, and the hormones go everywhere in our body. I mean, our hormones are just messengers that go around every single cell in our body. And so there's been this misunderstanding, I think, of what the sex hormones are. There's misunderstanding of the menopause. Like we've said, people keep talking about periods. It's not about periods, really. It's about how these hormones affect our body. So no one's been that interested. And then the women have just been, I don't know if you use the term over here, gaslit. They've just, this medical gaslighting. And it's gone on for years. If you think in the 60s and 70s, women were given benzodiazepines to calm them down. They were given all sorts of weird operations to try and control their temper and their mood. And this is because those hormones, the estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, are really important in our brains. And when the levels fluctuate and reduce, it can trigger so many symptoms. So low mood, anxiety, memory problems, poor sleep, reduced concentration. But because it's hard to make a diagnosis, we can't do a blood test or a scan, people are just, oh, it must be something else, not putting the pieces together. And then if we're waiting for a whole year after the period, that means for many women, there's lots of years of suffering and often being diagnosed with depression, with headaches, with maybe an arthritis, fibromyalgia, lots of other conditions, because no one is sort of owning and understanding the menopause, and the training is still lacking for so many healthcare professionals.
Because there are 200 different estrogen receptors in our body, isn't there?
There's loads. Every single cell in our body responds to estrogen, but also progesterone and testosterone. And so estrogen is very anti-inflammatory. It affects more than 1,000 processes in our body. You know, we have the hormones for a reason. So not everybody will experience symptoms, or not everyone will experience every symptom, but many people do experience symptoms, but often don't realize they're related.
So here the HRT comes in with the hormone replacement therapy. Should every woman have HRT?
Yeah, it's a great question, isn't it? So we've sort of, people realized how good HRT was and many years ago. And then this big study happened, which in hindsight probably should never have happened, called the Women's Health Initiative, the WHI study. And that was looking, because everyone realized that firstly, women were feeling better taking hormones, which is not a bad thing. Women feel better. But also they realized their bones were stronger. They were healthier as well, which again makes sense the way our hormones work. So they did this study, but they wanted to do it as a randomized control study. So half the women were given a placebo. So they had to find women who didn't have symptoms. Now, it's quite hard to find women without symptoms, because they knew that HRT is so effective. If they were giving it to women who were symptoms and half had the placebo, you'd quickly know who was having the placebo. So the average age of the women in the study was 63, so quite a lot older than you normally start HRT. And it was given an older type of hormone replacement therapy than we use now. So it was derived from pregnant horses' urine. It was a tablet. It had a synthetic progesterone in it as well. So they all have risks. So all types of hormones are quite different, but these were very synthetic, so not natural, if you see what I mean. And then they followed the women up. They saw that there was possibly this increased risk of breast cancer. So they stopped the study. They reported this finding to the press, and that was it. Everyone stopped taking HRT. But when they analysed the data properly, which they should have done before it went to the press, they actually found that this increased risk wasn't statistically significant, and actually there were still benefits from taking the HRT too. But it's now over 20 years since that study. Everyone keeps talking about it, but we don't usually prescribe those types of HRT. I hardly ever prescribe them, and the horse's urine estrogen I never prescribe. Synthetic progesterone I hardly ever prescribe. We're really fortunate that we've got natural hormones, and you have over here too.
Yes.
They're derived from yam plants. When you look under the microscope, they're exactly the same hormones as the hormones we produce when we're younger. And when we call it HRT, the replacement, when we start it in the perimenopause, we're not replacing any hormones, we're just topping up. Mm. So it's a sort of natural hormone supplement, really.
We should change the name.
I think we should. Yeah. Definitely.
That's a good idea. Many of our listeners on the podcast is also working in healthcare, and we all are experiencing either we are women or we maybe live with women. And my question is, for us all, what should we look for when we think that we might need to see a doctor? We are experiencing some changes, but what are the common symptoms you see in perimenopause, and when should we consider to see a doctor?
Yeah, it's a great question because there are so many symptoms. Mm-hmm. And certainly when we've looked at Balance, where we've got thousands of women who have put down and recorded their symptoms, the commonest symptoms are the ones affecting our brain. So like I've said, the memory problems, the fatigue, the poor sleep, the low mood, the anxiety, the poor concentration, reduced libido is very common. Some people do get the flushes and sweats, muscle and joint pains, headaches, palpitations, dry skin. You know, the list goes on, but you don't have to have a certain number of symptoms before seeing somebody, and you don't have to have a certain severity of symptoms as well. It can be very difficult because all those symptoms can be due to other things as well. Mm-hmm. But women often know, actually, because a lot of women experience some symptoms just before their periods, because naturally, just before our periods is where our hormone levels are very low. And so people can get a taster for what it's like being perimenopausal or menopausal. So often it's worth just thinking, is there anything else going on in my life or anything else that might be causing these symptoms? Or do you think they might be related to your hormones? If the answer is, it could be related to my hormones, they're similar symptoms, but maybe a little bit worse than I had before, then that's the time to go and get help, because we know from all the evidence that the earlier a woman takes hormones, the better. Mm-hmm. And that's for two reasons. Firstly, because they feel better. Mm-hmm. And certainly in medicine as a doctor, we don't want people to suffer. But secondly, because our hormones are very anti-inflammatory in our body, reduce the risk of diseases, the sooner people are on hormones mm-hmm. that are the right dose and type for them, the lower the risk of diseases. So with the menopause, there's two problems, really. There's a problem of symptoms, but also there's increased risk of diseases that are related to inflammation. And these are really common diseases. So heart disease, osteoporosis, diabetes, dementia, even an earlier death as well. So it's quite negative being menopausal. We obviously need to look at our nutrition, our exercise, our well-being, but we can't replace the hormones and treat the underlying cause unless we take these natural hormones.
Mm-hmm. And it pops up for me about endometriosis because this inflammation process is often put down by removing the estrogen. How would that affect this patient group?
Yeah, so endometriosis is interesting because, as I'm sure you and some of the listeners know, it's where you have the lining of the or tissue that's similar to the lining of the womb elsewhere in the body. So it can react to estrogen and build up. But actually, it's about the balance of hormones. So it's very simplistic to think, right, I'll remove the estrogen and things will calm down. And they can, but then you're withdrawing estrogen, which is a biologically active, important hormone in our bodies. Mm-hmm. Often, actually, with endometriosis, it can be the balance, especially with progesterone as well. Mm-hmm. And people often forget that pure progesterone is a really important hormone. Mm. It's a precursor for estrogen and testosterone as well. Mm. And it's very anti-inflammatory. So increasingly, the more that we manage women with endometriosis and read about it, it can be related to not having enough progesterone. So if you give more progesterone and then sneak in some estrogen, often women feel a lot better. Mm. And it's the problem is, it's the same globally. There's just not enough research into women's health and women's hormones as well.
Oh. So what I find problematic then is that, okay, you go and see a general practitioner or someone else and you get HRT and then try this. And then you don't have like the checkups and the follow-ups. Mm. So how should that how should it look like the follow-ups and the checkups?
Yeah. Mm. So in we're all different. Mm. And so when we talk about HRT, it's not a one size fits all. It's not a have a tablet and there you go.
Yeah.
We're all different, especially when we start hormones in the perimenopause, is when our hormone levels are fluctuating. So it can be quite hard to get the right dose. And then you've got the right dose and then your hormone levels change. And so then you might need the dose changing. So certainly in the UK, in our clinic, we see people first, we start a type of hormone, and then we review them after 3 months and then see how they're getting on. We don't do a blood test to diagnose the perimenopause or menopause because they can be so unreliable. But we often do an estrogen blood test when people are using estrogen to see, are they absorbing it? If they're still having symptoms and their level's low, we know we can change the dose. And then testosterone is another hormone that we often use as well. And when people start testosterone, we usually monitor them after between 3 and 6 months. And then when people are stable, then we review every year. Yeah. But we'll often work very closely with patients because women aren't stupid. Mm-hmm. They know that they can increase or reduce or change the dose. And some women in the perimenopause say, well, as soon as I've had my period, I feel a lot better. Mm. And then I start to feel worse again. Well, in those days that people are feeling worse, they might need a slightly higher dose of hormones. Mm. But we have to remember each dose of hormones is still low compared to the contraceptive pill, which firstly is synthetic. Mm. It's actually got a higher amount of estrogen in it. Sure. So everyone seems worried about natural hormones, but less worried about other hormones.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. And can testosterone is... We are allowed to prescribe it in Norway, but we're maybe not that familiar with when to prescribe, to what women. What is your personal advice for us as doctors? When should we think about testosterone for our patients?
Yeah, it's interesting with testosterone because if I'd come over 10 years ago, I would have said, well, women don't have testosterone. I've never learned that.
Exactly, yeah.
And so now I've learned a lot. Mm. And actually, testosterone is the most biologically active hormone that we have in women. Mm. And we all have more testosterone than estrogen when we're young. And the levels decline with age. So it's not a menopause-related hormone. It's more of an age-related hormone. Mm. But a lot of testosterone gets produced in our ovaries. So of course, if your ovaries don't work or they're removed at a younger age, you'll be more testosterone deficient than you would be otherwise. It's also produced in our brain as well. So it's not just our ovaries that produce it. But we have receptors for testosterone all over our body. Now, the problem with testosterone is that all the research has been done on libido.
Yes.
Now, but if we look at the definition of libido, of what Freud talked about libido, it was about enjoyment of life, not just pleasure of intercourse and sex, which I think is really important because a lot of women I see with testosterone deficiency tell me that they have no joy for life. Their pleasure's gone. They open the curtains and they see the sun and they're just not happy. They said they're just swimming in treacle. Then they're not thinking, they're not energetic. Mm. And so a lot of people find that when they use testosterone, their mood, their energy, their stamina, their sleep really improves, which is no surprise, but we haven't got the studies because they have not been done. Mm. But that's where I think with a lot of things in medicine, you use common sense as well.
Yes.
And all we're doing with testosterone is replacing what's missing.
Yes.
So you can measure blood tests, make sure they're still in the female range. Mm-hmm. We don't see patients that have, hairy faces and hair on their arms and deep voices. We just don't really see side effects because people are just using the amount that they need to top up.
And I think that's so important because we are taught about the adverse effects of what we have to tell our patients.
Yes.
But in reality, like you said, it's much higher doses that will make this adverse effect.
Absolutely, the people that I have seen with side effects are people that have either bought it online and not know the dose, or they've gone to clinics where they haven't got a lot of experience, and then you do a level and you've noticed it's very high. Yeah. But actually, women I've seen, when they reduce the dose to a normal dose, their side effects have reduced anyway. So those side effects are reversible. But we have to think, and I don't know what it's like over here, but certainly in the UK, a lot of women who have low mood, memory problems, fatigue, are given antidepressants.
Yes.
There are a lot more risks of long-term antidepressants than there are with the theoretical risks of testosterone. Mm. So in medicine, everything's a balance, but actually it's about sharing uncertainty with patients as well and allowing patients to choose.
Yeah.
I think it's a real shame when we just say, no, you can't have something.
Oh, great.
Because it's just a hormone as well, yes. You know?
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, because that's so important that we know and we think about in our clinical practice that. But would you prescribe estrogen and progesterone first before you start testosterone, or can you sometimes start everything at once?
Yeah, so it's interesting, isn't it? Because when we look at the guidelines, it says that we can consider testosterone if women have reduced sexual desire despite taking HRT. So when I started my clinic 8 years ago, that's exactly what I used to do. Most women, when you talk to them in a confidential manner, will say that their libido is reduced and their sexual desire is reduced. But increasingly, I'm seeing women who are younger, who are perimenopausal, who have symptoms of testosterone deficiency, and they want to start testosterone. They don't want to wait. You know, many of them have lost their jobs. They're not working. They're really struggling with symptoms. And again, as a doctor, I don't want to be saying, no, wait. I give them the choice. And so I also feel it is another hormone. There's this theory that you have to be estrogenized first and have enough estrogen and then add in testosterone. But that doesn't quite make sense physiologically to me. And then people say, some of the menopause societies are saying women have to be severely psychologically distressed with their reduced libido before considering testosterone. Now, as a doctor, I don't want to wait for someone to be severely psychologically distressed.
That's so true.
I think that's really quite hard. Mm. And especially when we know that there are benefits, and we've analysed our data from the clinic, and certainly the improvements in mood, energy, concentration, joint pain, sleep is more significant than the libido improvements. Mm-hmm. And other clinics are reporting the same. Yeah. So I think it's wrong to deny somebody something. If you know, it's about choice. And there are some women, and some clinics are doing it more, actually, that are starting testosterone before HRT for some women who are more testosterone deficient. So I think it's an area that we have to do more research on. It's really important.
So important.
But we shouldn't be denying people until we've got the research, because not everything in medicine, we have solid research. We have to remember clinical experience is really huge. And we've got thousands of women in our clinic that we monitor, and we look at the symptoms, and we've shown really good results.
So interesting.
I've asked myself this question in my clinical practice, if long-term stress or trauma and high cortisol levels could be something that contributes to deficiency of estrogen, for example, or perimenopause coming on quicker. What do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right, actually. It's very hard to know, because we can never, unless people are identical twins, of course, to actually know. But we do know that with some groups of women that have an earlier menopause, so they're younger when they're menopausal, so women who have a lot of stress. So say, for example, domestic abuse. We know women who are subject to domestic abuse, either physical or sexual, or both, have an earlier menopause at a younger age and more severe symptoms. Women living with HIV more likely to have an earlier menopause. So we know that the body's response, if you're under a difficult situation, is obviously to switch off the ovaries, because it doesn't want us to get pregnant. Mm. Very clever, isn't it, our bodies? So women who are drug abuse, women with eating disorders, again, but a lot of those women then will have more psychological symptoms, but sadly people will think, oh, it's related to the abuse or their lifestyle, and won't be realizing it's related to the hormones. And so you get this amplification and worsening of effect. So by the time we see these women, they've had such a long time of difficulties. And you're absolutely right, when you think about cortisol, adrenaline, noradrenaline, these are all really important hormones and neurotransmitters in our brain. So when we've got more of one, it can affect the level of other hormones. But we also know that estrogen, progesterone, testosterone are neurotransmitters. And when we have low levels, then it can change the levels of all the other hormones as well, including cortisol, noradrenaline, and adrenaline. So you've got this compounding effect, really. So yes, I think you're absolutely right.
But then we are talking about like trauma and stress. But how about like what we eat as stressors and how we eat? What are your thoughts about your dieting habits? And
It's really important, actually, because sometimes in medicine we're very simplistic, and we think, right, we'll give a treatment and that's it. Yes, of course, treatment can help, but there's no point having a treatment and then not looking at everything else as well. We know that our nutrition is so important. We've talked about inflammation that can occur without hormones, but we know if people have processed food, if they drink alcohol, if they smoke, there's increased inflammation in the body as well. So there's little point, there is still some point, but there's little point in someone just taking HRT and then eating burgers, smoking 20 a day, drinking, it's not going to have the same beneficial effects. And so we spend a lot of time in the clinic looking very holistically at everything for women. But the problem is, in the past, people have been so scared of hormones or HRT that they've spent so long looking at their nutrition and their exercise. And then women often, you're setting yourself up to fail because you often can't exercise because you have symptoms. Or women tend to put on weight because they haven't got the same hormones. So your body's trying to produce estrogen from fat cells, your metabolism's changing. So it can be really difficult to optimize your lifestyle if you haven't got hormones on board.
That's so interesting to see like the holistic person in front of you. Because if you're lacking, I remember listening to one of your very interesting podcasts recently as well, where you talked about hormones, of course, but together with exercise, enough rest, and nutrition and relations. Like if you're lacking one of these, you might not feel great, even though you are having your hormones replaced, but still you need to think about the whole whole life, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's so easy to forget it. It really is. And again, not being rude about gynecologists, of course, if you hear, as general practitioners, we are really well placed because especially it used to be easier as a general practitioner that we knew people for many years. So if there was any stress or trauma, you can deal with everything together. And that's really important because we also have to remember that whether we have symptoms or not, the menopause will last until the day we die.
Yeah.
So it's not just a short-term process. And I think that's the other thing. For many years, people think it's only related to symptoms. So once I haven't got symptoms, then I'm fine again. Of course, you're not. You've still got these low hormones. So when we're preparing for what's to come, if people are young, then we should really be thinking about how are we going to optimize our lifestyle, our nutrition, everything else as well. Because it's really hard to make changes when you're in the depths of something as well.
So we are thinking holistically, but I just want to emphasize again, because we still have women jumping off their chair when we suggest hormone replacement therapy. So the evidence base, if you could talk a bit more about that, just to assure the listeners.
So I think it's really important. When people hear the letters HRT, they just think about breast cancer. So it's really important to know that the natural body identical hormones, so the hormones related to what we produce when we're younger, there's never been a study to show there's an increased risk of breast cancer. Even if you take the worst sort of studies, if you like, showing the worst results with the older types of hormones, that increased risk of breast cancer is incredibly small. So a woman is more likely to have breast cancer if she drinks a couple of glasses of wine, if she's overweight or doesn't exercise, because they're all risk factors for breast cancer. So the risk is low. Even if someone did develop breast cancer taking HRT, then the studies have shown that their outlook is better, their prognosis is better. But then we have to think about what are the benefits of taking HRT. I've already said if you get the right dose and type of hormones, people will feel better. But actually, more importantly, we know from studies there's a reduction risk of all the diseases associated with the menopause. So especially when you look at heart disease, there's about a 50% reduction of heart disease incidence. When we know most women globally die from heart disease, that's really significant. There's also a lowering of osteoporosis, and we know around one in two women over the age of 50 have osteoporosis. So osteoporosis reduces. We know that type 2 diabetes reduces. We also know that clinical depression reduces as well, and other mental health conditions. But also there is increasingly evidence that body identical hormones reduce risk of dementia as well. And that's really important. We're all scared of dementia too. So a lot of it, I think we should be thinking, what are the risks of not taking hormones? Because for 20 years, we've been thinking about what are the risks of taking it? Well, what are the risks of not taking it? Well, you've got this risk of diseases as well, which is really important, and risk of not feeling well as well. We're lucky that the natural hormones, when we give estrogen through the skin as a patch or gel, or there's a spray as well, they have no risk of clot. So in the past, we were worried about clot and stroke risk. Well, we don't have that now. We were worried about breast cancer risk. Well, most types, like I say, there isn't an association with breast cancer. And actually, if you think there are natural hormones, why would our natural hormones cause cancer? It doesn't make sense. So there are many, many benefits from taking it. And the problem is that a lot of healthcare professionals haven't had the right training. Women haven't been given the right knowledge. It's been shrouded in mystery. And then we've been scared of something that we don't know enough about. So that's why it's so important to get the right information so women can make the right decisions and healthcare professionals can make the right decisions based on the right evidence as well.
I have a couple of questions because a lot of women suffers also from breast cancer and they are really struggling
the adverse effect of the treatment, basically.
The adverse effects of the treatment. And what are your thoughts about HRT after receiving, after breast cancer?
Yeah, so it's a big question. And there are lots of different answers, actually. But breast cancer is very common. You know, it affects around 1 in 7 women. And there's a lot of people who are told, absolutely, can never have HRT. Well, in medicine, I don't think you can ever say no. It's always weighing up the benefits and risks for that individual. Now, there are different types of breast cancer. They talk about whether they're estrogen receptor positive or negative. And the first thing to know, and it's really important, that if a breast cancer is estrogen receptor positive, it doesn't mean it's been caused by estrogen. Because some people, certainly in the UK, will say an estrogen-driven or estrogen-caused breast cancer. I've already said there are estrogen receptors all around our body. So it's very natural to have estrogen receptors. And actually, the estrogen receptor negative breast cancers is because the cancer has mutated and changed so much, the receptors have gone. So it's not like it's developed estrogen receptors, it's actually the reverse, which I think is really important for people to know, because otherwise they think the estrogen's bad. Now, some of the treatments when women have had an estrogen receptor positive cancer are to block estrogen in the body. And the main treatment for breast cancer, obviously, is surgery. There's radiotherapy as well. Some people have chemotherapy, but these estrogen blocking treatments have been shown in some women to improve outcome. But actually, when you look at the figures, it's actually quite small for that individual. So there's a lot of women who are receiving these estrogen blocking treatments with adverse effects for some women without much benefit. And that's where we use this individualized risk score. We use something called PREDICT in the UK to work out what are the benefits of that individual treatment for that individual person. But the outcome from breast cancer is actually really good. So I saw someone in my clinic last week who had breast cancer 20 years ago. It was an estrogen receptor negative breast cancer. She's now got osteoporosis. She's given up her work. She said, I'm just living. I'm just existing. I'm not really living. I'm not enjoying my life. I've tried all these alternatives. I'm getting recurrent urinary tract infections. I feel dreadful. But I've been told I can never, ever have hormones. Well, her outlook is really good. She had an estrogen receptor negative cancer. She can certainly use vaginal hormones, and so can people who've had an estrogen receptor positive cancer, because they only work locally and they don't go in the rest of the body. And actually, for her, she can probably safely take HRT. I'm saying probably safely because we haven't got robust studies, but there's no logical reason why she can't. But even women who've had estrogen receptor positive cancer may choose that they want the benefits from HRT, because whether someone's had breast cancer or not, they still have benefits to their heart, bone and brains from the hormones. And some women, I've had patients who are more worried about osteoporosis than they are about a breast cancer recurrence. And one lady said to me recently, I had such an awful menopause, I cannot stop my HRT even though I've had breast cancer. But if I had another breast cancer, I would prefer to go through all that treatment again than to go through my menopause again. So this is where individualization of choice is really important. We've been working with a group of people in the UK looking at all the evidence about HRT following breast cancer. And in fact, the evidence is really scanty. It's not, no good robust studies have been done. So we're producing a whole group of consensus statements as to what are the benefits, what are the potential risks, and hopefully that will be published soon to help people.
In Norway, we are taught that you have to wait until they finish their anti-estrogen treatment before we can start local estrogen. Is that true?
No. So there's some good studies that have recently come out, actually, again, being really reassuring, showing that vaginal hormones, so we've got vaginal estrogen, or we've got vaginal progesterone, which you have over here, which is, it's DHEA, it converts to estrogen and testosterone. But they only work locally in the vagina, so they work in the surrounding tissues, so they can be really good for women who have urinary symptoms, cystitis, urinary tract infections, and also vaginal symptoms. A lot of people have soreness, discomfort. You can still have them if you're having adjuvant treatment as well. We have been traditionally taught that if people are using aromatase inhibitors, they shouldn't use vaginal hormones. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for that. The aromatase inhibitors will strip the body of all estrogen, as you know. They might not work as well, but they can still work. And there are some oncologists, actually, that think everybody who's on aromatase inhibitor should use vaginal hormones. The problem is a lot of women are too sort of scared to talk to their oncologists about it, but we know that it's a very common symptom. There's no logical reason, and actually the safety data is very reassuring as well.
That's so important because I see many women who's on this treatment and they're really suffering.
Yes.
Their vagina symptoms are so affecting their quality of life. And if you can still have this treatment, I think that will help so many women.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, if some people, we know a lot of women actually stop using aromatase inhibitors because they're limited by the side effects. So if we can give something that will, you know, allow them to continue the treatment, that's really good. There are some women now that they're extending treatment from 5 to 10 years, which is a long time. We've just done a survey actually looking at women who've had breast cancer, the treatments, the knowledge that they have about the menopause, because a lot of women are told, oh, well, you might become menopausal when you have these treatments, but they're very much focused on, oh, your periods might stop. They're not realizing the other symptoms are related to some of these treatments. And sometimes with, say, an aromatase inhibitor, if someone is getting a lot of side effects, then we can maybe change the treatment as well. So it's really important that women know that there are options. And sometimes we just give people a 6-week holiday, if you like, where they don't take the drugs, or they might change to tamoxifen. Increasingly, there's more and more research looking at giving testosterone alone for women who are on aromatase inhibitor. And there's some good research in America showing actually these women have a better outcome for their breast cancer, but also a better quality of life as well. And so that's another reason that testosterone might be more beneficial for these women who've had breast cancer as well.
But it's all like
with anything, it's very individual as well. Mm. And it's really weighing up. We work closely with the oncologists who are with the patient. But a lot of doctors are scared. They're scared of almost being sued. They're scared of doing the wrong thing, which I understand. But actually, my priority is the patients and sharing uncertainty and allowing patients to choose. And the other thing, sometimes people who've had breast cancer say, well, I'm going to try HRT for a few weeks and then we can then assess how they feel. Because if they're not going to feel much better, there's no point taking it. But some women will say, do you know what? This has transformed my life. I feel incredible. Now I've decided I'm going to continue. That's up to them. I don't live with them every day. I don't see them waking up in the night or seeing how stressful their symptoms are. So I think that's where we have to be more grown up in our approach. You know, we shouldn't be paternalistic as doctors. You know, when I trained in the 80s, everyone was very paternalistic. But now we can be more flexible and include our patients in the decisions. But also we can remind remind patients that any decision they make today is not irreversible. So they can stop treatment, or they can change their mind, or they can maybe say no now, and then in the future, no, it is an option if their symptoms get worse.
Mm, that's very beautiful said, I think, because that's why we are healthcare professionals.
Of course it is. And
we want to help our patients to have better quality of life.
Yeah.
But as you said earlier, earlier is better when it comes to HRT, but what about the old elderly women?
Yes. Mm. So that's very interesting, because when we look at this WHI study, they, as I said, the average age in this study was 63, so they were starting older. And they found that the women, when they started older, actually had a slightly higher incidence of heart disease. But a lot of those women had heart disease already. A lot of them were overweight or obese. So they weren't the average person that you would necessarily start HRT on. So a lot of people say we shouldn't be starting HRT in women over the age of 60 because of this study. Now, we have to remember that, like I said, the HRT they used in that study was very different. So if I had someone, and I often do, in front of me who's in their 60s, 70s, 80s, I had someone who was 90, recently who wanted to start HRT, I would never give them the HRT that was in the WHI study. I would never give them tablet estrogen. I would never give them synthetic progestogen, because we know there are small risks with those. But we're lucky. We've got the natural hormones that we can start in lower doses, which we often do. And we know that even lower doses of estrogen through the skin still have a protective effect on the bones. So the women, I've seen women who've had 30 years of symptoms, been really struggling, and literally within weeks start to feel better. Mm. I've had others where they don't feel so much better, but they do find that they're sleeping better, they've got less joint pain, or they might have some better urinary, you know, urinary symptoms have improved. It's all very individual. We don't know whether it's safe or not because we haven't done studies, but actually common sense will tell us, because we know the hormones are very anti-inflammatory. And there's a lot of women who have missed out on HRT while this WHI study has been spoken about, and they're still struggling. And a lot of women say, oh, I don't really have symptoms, but then you ask them what their sleep's like. Yeah. Do they have any muscle or joint pain? Do they have any urinary symptoms? And they say, oh, yes, but it's part of getting older. And that's where giving some HRT, you'll soon know whether it's related or not. And everybody, whatever age, can use vaginal hormones as well. And that's important to know, that also about 20% of women who are taking HRT might still need to use vaginal hormones. And that's really important when we look at how common urinary incontinence is, you know, recurrent urinary tract infections, sepsis due to urinary tract infections is really common, yet very few women are given vaginal hormones.
Hmm. Maybe vulvodynia as well.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Yes.
So the last question, what inspired you to start working with the menopause and open all your clinics in the UK?
Well, it was never on the plan, actually. So when I started 8 years ago, my plan was to work one day a week doing menopause work, because I was listening to some of my friends who were coming out of their doctors being given citalopram, venlafaxine, sertraline, all antidepressants. And I knew they weren't depressed. And I said, get on some HRT, you're menopausal. And they said, no, we've been told it's too dangerous. So then I opened a clinic thinking, well, I can help some friends, some local people I know. I had no idea the suffering of women until I started to go on so do my social media, start doing some media, listening to stories from women. And then the clinic just got busier and busier. And so the clinic has increased to cope with the demand. But actually, I do a lot of work where I'm not seeing the patients. We do a lot of outreach work, a lot of work for people who are really disadvantaged. And that's actually really rewarding, but it's also really harrowing as well. And so obviously setting up the Balance app was a way that we could give free information out to people. But it's, as you know, it's quite addictive, because you know that you can help people, but it's really frustrating because it's very simple medicine. You know, my husband's a reconstructive surgeon. I can't suture. Like, I could not do his job, but I could train him to give basic hormones back. It's not difficult. The difficulty is listening to the stories, knowing the inequality of care, and you know, but there's a lot changing, and it's wonderful, obviously, to be here in Norway listening to this appetite for knowledge. And, you know, allowing women a choice is the most important thing. I don't mind who takes HRT. What I really strongly think is everybody who wants it should be allowed to have it. And until that happens, then I'm not going to keep quiet.
Thank you so much, Louise, for your work. And thank you so much for joining this podcast. Oh, it has been such a big honor. And to have you here like in Oslo with us. Oh my God.
Educating us on our hormones and changing lives, actually. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Louise.
Thank you.